Well, it is a great pleasure this week to meet Chris Solomon. And Chris, now we met, I think, for the first time about a year ago here on the University of Kent campus.
Roughly, I would think, yes.
And you've been wonderfully actively involved in our Religious Studies Society and our research seminars. But do you want to say a little bit about what you, well, are doing now, but also what you were doing, certainly up until COVID, at the University of Kent?
Sure. I'll do that in reverse, if I might. So basically, I was at the University of Kent for, I think, something like 26 years. I came as a lecturer in, let me cast my mind back, I think it was 1995, January 1995. And then I retired at the end of June, I think it was 2020. So I was in the physics department all those years. I guess my main interest really was in face recognition, problems of that kind. Subsequently, I mean, or rather during the time that I was at the university, I started a company, a spin-out company called Vision Metric, which I think has been moderately successful. You know, we've sold our software to a number of police forces around the world. And since I retired, I mean, that's been the main thing that sort of kept me off the streets, you know.
And I was just thinking earlier, because about half an hour ago, before we were doing this, I was just putting some thoughts together about the film Oppenheimer, which is about the great physicist. And I was thinking, gosh, I wonder if I know any great physicists who can shed some light about the work of Oppenheimer. But face recognition. So that sounds like an area that has a huge amount of currency.
It is. I mean, what I suppose might seem strange, Chris, is that it's not generally an area that you would do in the physics department, but it's just kind of the way that my sort of career took me, really. I mean, I did my PhD actually in medical physics, which is imaging. And then when I came to Kent, I kind of developed this special interest, I suppose, in sort of face synthesis and face recognition. And I suppose it'd be fair to say that certainly my research career, at least, was largely built on that. So it was something that's not common in physics departments. It's something you'd more commonly find in perhaps computer science departments or maybe even mathematics departments,
I'm always drawn by something that my PhD supervisor said many years ago about how the best research is often that which is done at the very cusp between disciplines, or where you're doing something that doesn't necessarily fit with what other people are doing, but actually that makes the conversation and the possible sort of networking and the coming together far more fruitful, because people might say, oh, you're not doing what I expect you to be doing, tell me more. Because if you're all doing the same sort of thing, or people assume that they know what you're doing, then often there's no point asking, because they're already pretty sure that they know what the answer is.
I mean, it seems to me there's definitely some truth in that. I mean, I think it probably, you know, in my case at least, it was that you develop certain skills or certain, you know, abilities, if you like, in when you study a certain discipline, which are not necessarily well known in another discipline. And it can sometimes happen that you know just the thing to kind of help you make progress on something, which somebody perhaps who was raised as an engineer or something might not necessarily have the same insight. So I think to some small degree that was probably true, you know, having been trained as a physicist certainly wasn't, I don't think, a disadvantage, you know.
And I suppose in a way that gets to the heart of, well, one of the reasons anyway I'm doing this podcast, which is that evolution. I know you're a physicist, not a biologist, but actually the evolution in terms of being someone who may have gone down a particular path, you mentioned medical physics, but actually along the way you start to find something quite bespoke, something that actually you want to do, and which might not actually be something that other people around you, your competitors or however you know, term them, might be interested in. So you sort of corner that market. Yeah. But I suppose there's that question, and it applies to me as well because of the various media interests that I have, as to where you situate yourself. And it sounds as though when you did leave, you moved on to something that actually seemed to be almost like the perfect follow-up from what you had been doing.
Well, I mean, as you're speaking, Chris, I was sort of, you kind of jogged my memory, really, which is that I think as a schoolboy, you know, I liked physics and I had obviously a certain ability for it. And I think I was drawn to study it, to be honest, because I think certain things in it sort of challenged one's idea of the world. So, you know, the notion that you have in relativity theory that time is not the same, you know, or moves at different rates in different, you know, or under different circumstances seemed to me rather fascinating. And then things like quantum mechanics. So I was kind of quite drawn to study that. And it sounds a strange thing to say, but I suppose I would honestly say that I kind of hoped that by studying physics, I would come to sort of learn or understand about something that really mattered. you know, changed one's life. I have to say, it's no disrespect for the study of physics, but when I went to university, I realised that was not the case. And it was rather functional, if that makes sense. Mm. In other words, it wasn't something that directly affected the way I live my life. Mm. Has its interest, of course, you know. So anyway, I mean, I did that degree. You know, I have positive memories on the whole, you know, not so much of studying physics, but of the university, you know. And then I had hoped, I think, initially to maybe do theoretical physics. But I think my 3 years at Durham sort of put me off that. One, I'm not sure I had the sort of raw intellectual ability to do that because it's very, very demanding in certain ways, or perhaps the mathematical skills. But I just didn't really fancy it. It was to me, it was too abstract. And I wanted perhaps something that was a bit more connected to the real world. And that's how I kind of veered towards, you know, medical physics.
Well, yeah. Because I was watching Oppenheimer on Friday evening when it came out, and aware that this is a three-hour film about a famous physicist that was, you know, competing with Barbie, you know, for the most popular movie of the year, and of course it's not dry physics. It's about the life of the person as much about the life of Oppenheimer as it is about what he did and about his relationships and his visions and so on, and that's the interesting bit, isn't it? That even a film like that has to have some kind of hinterland, has to look at the way that he was impacted upon by other people, up as the whole subatomic theory thing, but you're changing what's going on and the way that we perceive things at different times. You know, so the film was sort of almost trying to do what its subject matter was all about sort of the way that there are various energies and things. I'm not a physicist, so I don't know, but it was sort of very clever at trying to sort of show that there's uncertainty in the way that we perceive people, and just as is the subject of the, you know, the physicist's work. And so what you're saying is really compelling, because there's that sense that you have a particular calling in a way, but you end up moving or migrating that calling to a different sort of area, which is sort of just about harnessed within the discipline, or you create your own discipline. I suppose I do that with a lot of my work on film. It wasn't something I did at university 30 years ago, but you found your own way through it. But then there comes a point maybe when you think, okay, you know, do I continue on this trajectory, or do I break off that trajectory in order to do something that's a bit more sort of in keeping with what your passions and your visions are?
Yeah, I think I could only possibly, you know, to be slightly repetitious. It was just that I think the sense that, I don't know really, that one could spend an awful lot of time studying theoretical physics, invest huge amounts of, you know, intellectual, maybe emotional energy into it, but sort of ostensibly get nowhere.
Yeah.
Or nobody, you know, nobody really cares at the end of the day, or very, very few people really care. I mean, perhaps for those who are especially gifted, they, you know, can make some genuine progress. But I think that's what I felt, that somehow it wasn't really right for, you know, wasn't right for me. You know, I had, if you like, my sort of, you know, particular bag that I'd been given, and I needed to make the best of it in a slightly different way. You know?
Okay. Well, yeah. I'm going to do something which I also, in keeping with my limited knowledge of physics, okay. Which is in terms of moving time around.
Yes.
So there'll be a bit of jumping forward and backwards. But as this is a nostalgia topic, do you want to say a little bit about what you mentioned being a schoolboy and some of the interest that you had?
Yeah.
But going back even further than that, what are perhaps your earliest memories?
Oh goodness. Yeah, I mean, I've got lots, of course, like everybody. I'll just fairly randomly try a few, Chris. I mean, I loved sport from a very young age. I was actually rather a good footballer as a young person. I mean, you know, right from being a small boy. And when I became a teenager, I suppose I had what you might call an outside chance of being a professional footballer. I played for a little while for Brighton's youth team. But I think really my, you know, in terms of sort of things that interested me, as a very small boy, as I say, I had a rather, you know, strong fascination with football and football teams and all kinds of things like that. But I did also love mathematics from a young age. And I don't think that was just because I happened to be quite good at it. I just seemed to have a, you know, a sort of fascination for it. I mean, gosh, you know, it's such a big thing, you know, to sort of, you know, I mean, obviously I've got many, many powerful memories. And I suppose, I don't know if we'll talk about that later on, but, you know, in terms of sort of, I suppose in what you might call sort of spiritual or religious interests. I guess that in a way they're always there in the background, but I wouldn't necessarily have been able to articulate them at all at that time.
Yeah.
It was something of a question about, you know, life and the nature of life. And I think even as a young child, there were occasions when I, you know, I can sort of recall when they popped up, you know.
Yeah, and interesting that actually, and that's something, because that's how I got to know you, because of your interest in a lot of the religious studies work, the mysticism that obviously perhaps fits with my subject area. But where did you grow up? So in terms of your childhood, where were you born?
Well, I mean, I was actually born in a place called Hayling Island, which is just off Portsmouth. But my family moved to London, to the Shepherd's Bush area, when I was very small, so I've got hardly any memories of that. I was perhaps 4 or 5 years old. But basically, about the age of 6, we moved to the Brighton area. Mm. Yeah. We moved to a few houses in the Brighton area, but basically we were in Brighton from the age of about 6. So that's where I grew up, by the seaside. And I went to school there. A primary school, there's nothing unusual about it, I think. It was a Church of England primary school, but, you know, it wasn't especially religious or anything. And I went to a large comprehensive until I was 16, a place called Tideway in New Haven. Had a sort of reputation as being a bit rough, I think, unjustifiably. But I have very good memories of being there, in a way. You know, I mean, it sounds a bit corny almost, but I feel that it was actually good for me. I'm sort of glad I went there rather than Eton or something, you know, because, you know, you get, I think, a slightly broader idea of, you know, you know, how people are and, you know, what, you know, their families and things like that, you know. And then I went to a sixth form college for my A-levels in Brighton, which had been a former grammar school, you know. So that was my sort of schooling history anyway, you know.
Yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it? That sort of notion of, you know, looking back sometimes, it's easy to see patterns, I suppose. But, you know, my own children now, my eldest is moving off to secondary school. And you're always sort of trying to plot the way and think, right, this is the right part. This is the right school. These are the best experiences you'll have. But actually, sometimes when you do things that are quite the opposite, maybe, of what your personality is like. And, you know, when you're very young, you often don't quite know what your personality is. And often it's tested by your interactions with others.
Yeah.
But often you look back and think, gosh, you know, that was the making of me. But you're right. If you put everybody into a school where everything is kind of already sort of all sorted for you, or everything is sort of there on a, you know, on a plate kind of thing, you probably would get very frustrated in some ways that you're not, haven't got the chance to have that sort of character building, because the only way that anybody can be who they are is in an interaction with other people. So it sounds like you actually had a really good background experience growing up around Brighton.
Yes, I mean, it's a bit difficult to sort of say this because I'm sounding a bit apologetic, but I certainly wouldn't want to present myself as some sort of working class hero, you know. But yeah. I do honestly think that, you know, going to a school like Tideway, where you had some kids who came from really quite difficult and deprived backgrounds, others were quite middle class and well to do and all that kind of thing. It's just a sort of, I felt I had a sort of exposure to different types of people and their lives and what motivates them and things. Then quite possibly I would have done, as I say, if I'd gone to a more privileged sort of, you know, school.
Yeah. And what did your parents? What did your parents do?
Oh, okay. Well, my mother was actually married 4 times, but I didn't actually know my biological father terribly well, because he and my mother separated when I was quite young. But I know that for a fact that, and I did meet him in later life, you know. But he was an artist, quite a good artist. He made his living largely from journalism. Mm. Right. And he went to live in Portugal, you know, in the later years of his life. My mother, she was, let's think, what did my mum do? I guess she's known because she was on television, right? But she didn't start doing her TV work until probably, probably in her 30s, I think. Yeah. So she had obviously 4 children. So I'm sure she had certain jobs when we were all young, but I don't remember what they were. But I think she probably spent her 20s just raising family. Mm. I know she did a bit of modelling work because she was actually rather good looking, my mother. And then, as I say, in her 30s, she kind of got a break. And she was on a television programme, which was on in the afternoons and aimed at housewives. Yeah. It was called House Party. And there'll be, I mean, not many people around these days who would know it, but in its day, it was actually quite a popular programme. It's mainly on Southern Television, which no longer exists. Yeah, so she did that. I mean, unfortunately, she died relatively young, in her late 40s. But that was basically what she did,
So was she presenting this programme?
Well, what it was, that there were actually six, there were sort of 6 people on each programme, and they would kind of have little 5-minute scenes where one of them would demonstrate the latest recipe that they, you know, had found. They might have a discussion together about, you know, you know, risky things like, you know, sex before marriage or things like that. You've got to remember this is the 1970s, you know, sort of thing. So, yeah, so I suppose, yes, she was a presenter, but there was kind of the group of women together doing things and having conversations. Mm. That was the format of the programme, yeah.
And is that something that you grew up watching? Was that would have been, so you'd have been quite young at the time, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it started, gosh, I would only have been, I don't know really, probably 8 or 9 years old, I think.
Yeah.
I don't remember terribly well now for how many years she actually did it, but I think it was actually probably to within a few years before she died. They may have stopped the program, I think, some, you know, that few years before she died. But
it's always funny because I suppose very recently I've started to do more sort of like TV type stuff. But my children, you know, rather than be starstruck by that, they either find it very embarrassing or just very odd. Like, why would you want to do something like that? Or it's just terribly boring to an 8 year old. Because unless I'm Indiana Jones, then frankly, me, you know, interviewing people or whatever is, you know, it would just seem to be a very dull way of spending an hour. And hardly sort of, you know, it's not quite.
That's right. Unless you're shooting up the baddies, eh? Yeah.
Well, that's right. In fact, I asked one of my sons the other day, we went to see Indiana Jones yesterday, and I said, so what's the appeal? And he was talking about he loves all the fighting and the killing and the shooting. And I was thinking, God, I'm taking my 8-year-old to see this. And, you know, sort of, you know. But to have someone, I mean, did it make you sort of see your mother differently in this sort of way? Because obviously you're doing something on TV and it's very, obviously there's a particular way of doing things because this is television. But, you know, did you sort of watch it and think, oh my goodness, you know, I see a different side to her?
No, I was probably a bit young for that, Chris. You know, I wouldn't say I was embarrassed by it or anything like that. But, you know, obviously the kids at school all knew about it and they would watch it and things like that. So they would sometimes say, oh, I saw your mum on television, you know, on Wednesday or something like that. She would sometimes sort of, for example, when we were a bit older, when I was, you know, in my teens, she would sometimes ask us for feedback, you know, like kind of how did it come across? And I was, I think, fairly honest, you know, about, you know, that kind of thing. But I can't honestly say that I felt I saw a different aspect of her.
But did it also mean then that you had lots of sort of like family friends or through the TV world, were you sort of exposed to some sort of interesting sort of like parties and opportunities? Like suddenly, wow, that's the guy who reads the news on the television or something like that.
Well, yeah. I suppose up to a point, we did have a few people. I mean, there would be the other ladies that were on the programme. Yeah. Most of those sort of came to visit us at some point. I mean, she was quite good friends with the lady Anita Roddick, who started the Body Shop. Yeah. Yes, and in fact, I remember quite well when we went to her house, Anita's house in Worthing. I would only have been a teenager then. At the time, she actually started the Body Shop. Yeah. You know, which is kind of strange because, of course, it became like £1 billion company. But
so that's how it started. So there we are.
Yeah, well, there we were. Yeah, having a conversation in her. You know, in her living room over dinner or something,
But I was talking to you earlier about, we used the word visionary about, you know, I mentioned Oppenheimer, but also sort of, you know, the vision that you did or didn't have within physics. But it sounds as though, you know, you witnessed this. I mean, I grew up with the world of Anita Roddick and the Body Shop.
I mean, I think, you know, my mother's acquaintance with her, probably, I honestly don't remember, but it probably when we've been for, you know, a couple of years or a few years or something. Because, of course, she became very, very busy after that, you know, and probably didn't even live in Worthing anymore, I'm not sure. But we knew them at a time. I think her husband, who was called Gordon, if I recall correctly, he just travelled around South America on horseback for a year or something like that. You know, at the time we had this sort of dinner party with them, you know. So he was, you know, discussing the ideas for the Body Shop, and I think had just started her first shop. Yeah. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah, so it sounded like he was living the American dream. But what about things like, you know, in terms of music or film, you know, growing up, was that? I mean, I was obsessed with the charts. I was obsessed with the top 40 on a Sunday at 5 o'clock on Radio One. Did you have any of those sort of interests?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I think like most teenagers. When I was young, like at primary school, it's all coming out now, Chris. I was a big fan of Slade and T-Rex and Sweet. They were these sort of, you know, bands of the time. Probably a few others.
That's like, so 1972, 73.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. There were a few others that I liked, but I think probably they were my favourites. When I became a teenager, I liked a lot sort of heavy rock. So I liked, shall I name a few?
Please.
I liked Jimi Hendrix, even though he was long before my time in a way, but nonetheless, I liked him. I liked, in particular, I liked a group called Bad Company. Possibly you might not know them, but The Who. Obviously, The Rolling Stones I liked too. I liked a group called Black Sabbath, which I'm a bit embarrassed by now, but I liked them a lot at the time.
But Black Sabbath, yeah. they were the ones with the very famous, that was that Ozzy Osbourne?
That's Ozzy Osbourne, yeah. Yes. Yeah. They did a rather famous song called Paranoid.
Yeah. Oh, I know, yeah.
I won't give a whole list, but obviously that kind of music, yeah. I think in my teens that was
And in those days, so in terms of listening, I don't know if you ever saw them live, but was the music, it was radio for me was the thing. So, of course, the fact that I have more of an interest in more sort of mainstream pop music says a lot about the fact that for me, growing up on radio and the sort of daytime radio, not John Peel stuff and more the sort of what Mike Reed or Simon Bates or whatever on Radio 1 in those days would have been playing. So that's sort of an interest that has tended to sort of carry over. But for the music that you were interested in, was it through records? You know, how would you discover that music? Where would you consume it?
I think probably, I'm sure some of it must have been through hearing it on the radio. I think people used to listen to the radio more in those days. But I think it was also through friends. You know, they would... they'd get the new record or something, and then you know you might go to their house and listen to it.
Yeah.
And you think, oh well, I'm going to buy that too. So I think it kind of spread in that way. Obviously, you didn't have any streaming; there's no internet in those days, anything like that. You know, so
that's the irony, isn't it? That in those days, you'd go to friends' houses, have a cup of tea, read their magazines, meet the cat or whatever, and listen to the music.
Yeah.
Whereas these days, you just press a button and you share it instantly with the whole world.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing I must say, actually, and this is. More when I was a teen, of course, was my stepfather was very keen on music, I think. He had a very large and good album collection. And so I actually, developed a lot of my musical interests from him. I could just sort of go through all his albums and play them and listen to them and that kind of thing, So that was also how I got to like some of the groups,
I always find, and this is something that's coming through in the nostalgia work as well, that the music that you'll listen, you're more likely to be exposed to when you're young, is what you'll listen to later on. So is the music that you listen to now pretty much on a continuum with those same artists that you grew up with?
Well, that's funny, really. I think I'd have to say sort of yes and no. I would never put on any of those records now. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't actually go and get an album and put them on. But of course, when I hear them, under certain circumstances, it sort of touches a part that, something else doesn't reach, I think, just because presumably it's a sort of an association of, something with the past. The truth is I don't actually very often say, right, I'm going to listen to a piece of music now and then choose one. I don't know, I don't often do that. But I suppose my when I do choose to listen to a piece of music, it's much less likely to be a pop music these days, I think, or something. I might choose some classical, maybe some religious music, music of religious origin, that kind of thing.
We'll come on to the religion.
I do
in a
listen
minute.
To occasional, some heavy rock. I must confess, in the car sometimes.
And you just made me think. I remember I must have been quite young, and I think I was in one of like a Beefeater restaurant, and with family, and they were playing lots of the music that I grew up with. I was very young at the time, so it was probably only about 5 or 6 years old. And somebody said, "Oh, it's a pity they got the music on so loud. We can hardly hear ourselves talk." And I was almost thinking, I'm having a transcendent experience because all this music here is completely like my sort of thing. So it was like exactly the sort of stuff if I'd had to pick the music, whatever it was in the day, lots of 80s sort of mainstream stuff probably, then that's the stuff I would have chosen. And that's the funny thing, isn't it? Because when you're in a public space, particularly all on the radio, that urge to share, to say to people, you must switch on now, it's the best song ever. And of course, the worst thing is somebody says, oh, I hate this song. And you're like, how dare you? profaning my sacred
crazy?
Experience.
Yeah.
But tell me about, so the interest in religion, it sounds as though that's something that has sort of followed you through from what you were telling me. Maybe incipiently early on. But it's definitely sort of come out of its shell. Or maybe I'm not using the right sort of metaphor. But it sounds as though this is something that has been a long-standing interest to you that has started to blossom in more recent years.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, it's very difficult to, of course, Chris, to sort of condense it, But I would, for example, I didn't go to a religious school. I didn't have religious parents. Yeah. In fact, I would say my take or my impression of religion from a young age was a fairly negative one. I mean, I just thought it's a load of nonsense, And I, to some degree, I would stand by that. In other words, that I think what sometimes people are, let's just say asked to believe is a kind of nonsense. But I think just somehow as I got older, I think as a teenager, I had one or two sort of difficult to articulate, but I suppose, one or two experiences that kind of, made me feel that there was a little bit of a mystery behind life. And it wasn't all just about, you know, enjoying yourself and, you know, nothing wrong with that, of course, but, you know, it wasn't just about that. And then I think, you know, probably it was around about the time that I went to university that I started, you know, it's whole question about relationships, what people live for. It's a whole question of, you know, a set of impressions, I suppose, started to make me become a little bit of a seeker, I suppose, you know, try to look for something that, that would, if you like, satisfy the inner part a bit more than just getting on with daily life, you know, if it makes some sense. I'm
does make sense. And, I'll try and unpack some of that, because in my own case, what's often happened is that people think, because I teach religious studies and went to a church school and did REA level at a time when it was not very popular.
Yeah.
You know, it was not the subject that most of my friends did, maths or physics or English. You know, I did English, but certainly RE was not the most obvious subject to do, even though it was a church school. And I think over the years, you know, people think, so why do you do this? Like, this is your vocation. This is your, you know, this is the subject that you chose to do, and you stayed in academia. So, you know, what's going on there? What's at the heart of that? And I think people have tried, perhaps in some cases, failed to try to work out exactly what is the underpinning connection or the thread, which might not be the same as that which has propelled other people to go down that path. Yeah. But I suppose I have my own sort of passions and fandoms and my own set of interests, which sometimes dovetail with, but are often also separate from what goes on in a more traditional sort of, let's say, a church sort of context. But in your case, so I think you said as well that earlier you went to a Church of England school.
A primary school.
It didn't... But
I mean, you had prayers in the morning at assembly, and that's it. But it was not a religious school, no.
Yeah, and that for me was the sort of reason why I was interested in those questions, because I didn't feel anything. Yes. I'd go to a church school and it was an excellent school, but I was never quite sure why we were doing all of this. Other than, you know, are we doing it because it's tradition? Are we doing it because it's the right thing to do? And there was no sense that the teachers were sort of giving off this sense that this was terribly important. It was more that it was done on rote. It was the thing to do because it was the school's ethos, rather than it had been communicated as being something that was uplifting or, you know, so religion always seemed to be quite cold and distant in many ways. Yeah. But in your case, it sounds like it wasn't like an Anglican or a Christian kind of interest. It was something what more spiritual, more mystical.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. As you were speaking, Chris, I suppose that might be able to sort of say a little bit better what I think was the difference for me. And it was, I came to sort of realize that, a life that's not sort of questioned. I mean, as a scientist, in a sense, you learn to ask questions. You know, how does this happen? How does it come into being, etc.? That kind of thing. And I think, although it's, I think, a different process because it's not in the same domain exactly. Nonetheless, I think there's an analogous process, which is that, you know, a religion that's not sort of directly brought into question and doesn't confront one's actual experience. You know, I struggle to see any real value in that. In other words, that, you know, people talk about things like, you know, faith grows, or it's something that can be born. And I think it seems to me that probably maybe it's something born over a long period of time and through one's experiences. But the notion that one would just simply believe something without bringing it into confrontation with your direct experience of life and with people and so forth, to me seems, you know, what would be the word? I was going to say a travesty, but it's in a way, it's a sort of abnegation of a certain responsibility, really, as a human being to sort of, you know, to do that, you know. So I think it was that. And I suppose from quite a young age, I became interested in sort of meditation. So my first interest really was Buddhism, I think, yeah. I never really explored it in a great deal of depth, but really quite young, maybe from the age of 15, I read one or two books about Buddhism, and I had a rather good teacher at school, my French teacher, actually, who sort of recognised that in me and had similar interests, and he gave me one or two books and things like that, you know. So I'm not jumping ahead, but I think, as you know, I mean, probably the most significant influence, really, that, you know, I came to was, you know, the Gurdjieff teaching, which is perhaps not very widely known, you know, and that's fine, you know, but...
Because you gave a paper not too many months ago to our research. Do you want to say a little bit about that? Because that was, I mean, I read that and I thought, my goodness me, you know, I've got so much to learn from here. But say a little bit about that set of interests.
Yeah, I mean, I could, you know, I suppose spend days really on that. But, the interest, you know, for me, I started quite young. So I sort of came to the Gurdjieff teaching. I think I was 22 at the time, so quite young, just a few weeks before my 23rd birthday. I hesitate to say this, Chris, because I mean, I don't know, you know, how this will find its way out into the world, or indeed if it does, but it would be misleading, I think, just for me to say that it's a form of Christianity or something like that, because that would not be accurate. It's neither a religion nor a philosophy, really. But as I try to sort of explain, I think, in the seminar, it is, I would say, wholly compatible with the Christian teaching and its aims. But it's one that I would say, you know, and Gurdjieff himself, this, that tries to enable people to, if you like, be a Christian. And he did say this on one or two occasions, that the wish, so to speak, to you know, to be equal to being a Christian is one that maybe many people would have. Turn the other cheek, you know, and so forth. But such as we are, we're not really capable of it. In other words, a prolonged training and a lot of struggle is necessary to begin to learn how to actually act in accordance, really, with those, you know, with the commandments, you know. So I wouldn't say that was the whole aim of his teaching, because there were many other influences, including Sufism, Sufism in particular, I think, and certainly some Tibetan influences too. I think they're quite clear in his teaching. But it's, I think, a really, you know, very remarkable, but also quite demanding, you know, quite demanding teaching, both in terms of time. I mean, it makes on your time, and of course, what it shows you about yourself.
Yeah. So, and is that something that you were ever able to share with colleagues? Did anybody know about those interests in a work, or was that something that was like a separate from work kind of space for?
Yes, to be honest, Chris, I think it's something I would always have been happy to talk to people about. But, and again, I, you know, feel a bit cautious about saying this, but to talk about it with some people is a waste of time. They won't thank you for it. Yeah. They won't find it interesting. It's not of interest for them. And so, in a sense, I would never really, I think, talk about that in any depth, unless I felt the other person had some genuine interest in it. You know, so it could be. I think it's because it relates not to sort of writing papers and achieving outer success in life and things like that, but really it's more about the inner man, you know.
But so, that can also be really important, because sometimes then, I mean, what people study professionally and academically in a university context can often have nothing at all to do with what they might do in the rest of their life. You know, I've met colleagues and you see them in some ways doing very, very good, but maybe quite dry, or you put them into sort of categories where they do and discover they have this amazing sort of penchant for dance or football or all sorts of things. You think, I never knew that. Yeah. And my obsession with music and the charts and things, which was, anybody who knew me growing up knew about that. But I guess sometimes when you're a bit older, you sometimes are liable to be a bit more strategic in terms of what you tell people. Like at a job interview, for example, you know, you're aware that sometimes they may not want to know about some of those.
Sure.
But if it comes up, you'll tell them.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't come up, then it's not necessary to know.
Yeah.
But people might go on social media now and think, gosh, you know, suddenly see a completely different side to you to the one that they've labelled you as.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's it. Then there's the man that sort of, how can I say, you know, gets along with everyday life and, you know, does his job and all that kind of thing. And, but, you know, I think it's not that one seeks to sort of, how can I say, have a secret life or anything, but I just think it's the nature of what we are. You know, you don't share everything with everybody, of course. Mm. And so, you know, I would say generally my sort of only ever really, you know, sort of talked about the teaching, I think, with those who either have a genuine, closely related interest or who are themselves interested in learning more about the teaching.
Yeah. And that does happen, doesn't it, sometimes? Because sometimes everybody needs that sort of privacy. But at the same time, I find that there are certain people where those sort of non-work things are what people associate with me. And so sometimes when you have, and it might happen on social media, when you've got, say, like a work colleague who knows you for one sort of set of things that you do, and somebody from your past, and they happen to be sort of reading the same post on something like Facebook, and they're suddenly both commenting on something that you've written, and you realise that different aspects of your life have in some way at just that moment come together. There's almost a bit of magic in that almost, because suddenly you're thinking, you know, I can't conceive of how that person from the 1980s or whatever, and this person who's one of my colleagues at work, and now suddenly, you know, but I'm the common link between them. And I think maybe in life that's something that we're always navigating, to try and work out actually who we are. I find that with often, you know, all these sort of celebrities, sometimes when you discover they have all these other lives and things, we think, yeah, my goodness me, you know, where did that come from? But actually, in a way, there is something, some need, I think, sometimes for something more integrative. Like, one, you know, I have a complete obsession with cinema, and also I used to be in, to different degrees, still am, all the sort of the writing down to the chart stuff when I was young. But I've sort of made academic projects out of them. And I think with you and the more sort of spiritual interest that we've just been talking about, that is also something that has also become a kind of academic project, albeit ironically, since leaving an academic post, but finding maybe you've got the freedom to explore that.
Yes, I mean, I think so, yeah. I mean, absolutely, Chris. I mean, I guess, you know, it was difficult to do this, but my interest in, I think, would be, you know, is, and is not so much to sort of, how can I say, you know, titillate people's intellects, but I suppose, you know, to try to express or to reach people, you know, who might actually have a genuine interest in, if you like, that aspect of life, you know. So in other words, you know, the academic endeavour is one, obviously I did it for 26 yeah. years and have a lot of respect for, and I was, you know, I was happy to do it and so forth. But it's an interesting area to navigate, you see, because I feel, I don't know if you would agree, but I feel that kind of what one might call a genuine spiritual understanding is not an intellectual matter. Yeah. It's not to say the intellect can't inform it, you know. It has a role, you know, in terms of, you know, pondering things and so forth. But it's not quite the same thing. So in other words, it may be possible for somebody to have a very fine grasp of words, to have read widely, you know, to be able to recite to you stuff from the Christian mystics and so forth. But in and of themselves, you know, do they understand something, you know, in that domain? And they're not the same thing. Yeah. So I think the interesting thing is how to sort of, you know, in a sense, come into contact with all that rich material, but for it to actually touch people, not just in their minds, yeah. but in, you know, in their whole being, yeah. their whole person. Maybe that's an impossible task, but I think I have some interest in that, you know, to sort of...
But often that sort of, I mean, of course it does fit very well with religion, but that sort of, that notion of, it could be the numinous, but that sense of something that you really feel.
Yeah.
And in a strange way, and actually I'm going to give an example now that might surprise you, but I have no interest in the 90s band Take That. But you know this musical, Greatest Days, that there's a film version that's just come out, and there's a stage show as well.
Yeah.
So I went along, but I watched everything that's out. And a lot of people I know would say, never going to go anywhere near that, because it's sort of, you're not interested. And I thought, well, I'm intrigued, because it's the, you know, I'm interested in nostalgia, and I knew this is like a 90s set thing. But you've got this sort of conversation between characters, young schoolgirls from the north of England in the 1990s, 93, and they're 25, you know, well, 25 years later, when they're in their, perhaps around their early 40s. And so it's using the music of Take That as the backdrop. Now, so a lot of people said, I'm not interested, there's no way I'm going to, you know, watch that. And I sat there transfixed, because I didn't go there and suddenly thought, I want to buy the whole back catalogue of Take That music.
Sure. Yeah.
he says very defensively. But what I did see was before me was my life of a sort of, not that I was, you know, not female schoolgirl working north of England in 1993. I don't mean that bit. But I saw the whole sense about the things that mattered to us at that age. 1993 was quite a pivotal year for me. It was during my university years. It's sort of one of those sort of coming of age type sort of moments when you sort of start, you know, academically things were going very well, and I was at university and sort of, you know, learning about myself, and had some wonderful friendships and so on. And that dialogue between the past and the present. And so I was watching this very, almost you could say, tacky, quite inconsequential thing, and saw something quite, you know, something other going on there.
Yes.
But when I described it to people, people would think, oh my God, you know, you're like some conversion to a 90s boy band. And it's like, that is absolutely not what it was. Yeah. But that's an interesting thing. And who would have thought? So I'm the theologian. who watches film, but actually found something more transcendent about that than any of the Oppenheimers or the Barbies or the Transformers or the Spider-Man films.
I don't know if you since we're on this subject, but and I'm sure you would have seen it, but I think one of the most fascinating programmes, or series, I should say, were the so-called Up series, 7 Up, 14 Up, 21 Up, 28 Up. Now, I was absolutely transfixed by that whole thing, and I'd watch those all day, sort of thing. And, it just seems to me that it must be because in watching these, we somehow see the patterns of our own lives and the aspirations and the disappointments. So you just get some sense that, of course, people's lives are different. But in some strange way, they're all terribly similar. Most people pass through similar sets of experiences at one point or another. So it's almost like a kind of template, And I think that, and I know I'm not alone in this, that almost every person I've ever spoken to says, what a marvellous and interesting sort of series of programmes. Yeah. I think I watched it from 7 Up all the way up to, I think the last one I saw was 56 or something. I don't know if I've done my maths right.
But I think you're right. Because the director, was it Michael Apted?
Michael Apted,
who also did a lot of
And I think he said he didn't think he'd be alive for the next one or something.
He died not too long ago.
Did he? Right, I didn't know that.
Possibly even during lockdown.
And
I think he was very, very late 70s, if not 80, when he died.
A marvellous
series. But he was very young. I think he was like a TV researcher in his early 20s when he started. Was it 63, I think it's, or 60, around that sort of period.
Something like that would it be, wouldn't it? Yeah.
And I think you're right. And I think making this series, and I watched a few of them. I mean, I'd love to re-explore them, actually.
Yeah.
But, of course, what you'd find is that some of those people, maybe they're a bit quirky, not really mainstream. 7 or 14 or 21 years later, some of those habits or those characteristics became inflated or accentuated. Some of them had mental health issues. Some of them perhaps didn't want to be involved in the project anymore. Some of them had more sort of regular routine.
And others, just soften in a certain way, which is rather nice to see.
It started off as you chart the course, you realise that each of these people, in a way, were mirroring our own lives and the people that we knew and grew up with.
Sure, I mean, I'm sure that accounts in some strange way for its sort of popularity, why so many people find it fascinating, because you kind of, relate it to your own life in some ways.
I remember watching, because he made one of the Bond films, I think, in the 90s. I think it was the one, it was definitely one of the Pierce Brosnan ones. So it might have been might have been The World Is Not Enough or something like that, or Tomorrow Never Dies or something. But it was so strange watching that, because I was thinking, this is that, he's making these amazing, he's a documentary historian. Yeah. But also making some good, he's very Bond good at making a few Hollywood blockbusters So in a way, his life was also mirrored. That, you imagine him spending his life researching these, these people go every 7 years. But of course, he also had a very, very, very capable, life as a film director. And it shows that we all wear multiple hats, which gets to the heart of what we're talking about. Yeah. Say a little bit about, university as well, because you obviously did physics. Do you want to say a little bit about where you went and, I suppose, also your motivations for doing physics at university?
Yeah, okay. Well, I was an undergraduate at Durham, which, it was a lovely place to be. Yeah. I think I sort of said earlier on that I did physics. Mm. I mean, I was perhaps slightly unusually in those days. I did four A levels. So I did English and French, and maths and physics. And I think until the end of my lower six, I was actually minded to try to study French at university. But I had a rather good physics teacher. He's a bit of a character called Mr. Harmon. I remember him well, and not through his direct persuasion, but I think just because of him and the way he taught physics, I decided that I would study physics at university, But I think, the reasons, were partly him, but also, as I said, because maybe something was sort of just stirring in me, but, some of these ideas from modern physics did seem to me rather amazing, like the idea that, time is not as sort of Newton said it was, the same for everybody in all parts of the universe, struck me as rather fascinating. And then some of these strange things about quantum mechanics, it's kind of this slight mystery, I suppose, to it that kind of slightly drew me in that direction, I think,
Do you know, you've now nailed it for me, because I've interviewed a couple of astrophysicists as part of this series,
yeah.
and they will also talk as much about wonder as they will about the hard facts of science.
Yes, yes.
And also they have that word counterpoint comes up a lot. One of them actually is one of my closest friends from school. He's out in, I think, Kuwait at the moment. And he does all this amazing sort of space work, but he also performs on stage in sort of pantomime and sort of cabaret drama societies. Uh-huh. And like me, he has this huge sort of, you know, back catalogue of music interests that sort of go back to the 1980s. And so it's almost as though, rather than be defined through a particular set of, you know, disciplines, there's always something else going on. And that notion of wonder is a thread, I think, that links with what you were saying earlier about some of the mystical interests and physics. So they're not actually incompatible at all. You were looking for answers.
Yes, I think that would be, you know, as I say, accurate. That, you know, again, if I repeat myself, I apologise, but it was that sense that definitely, because I remember that so well, that I went to Durham all rather excited and went into the lecture theatre, you know, for the course on relativity theory. I was really very excited. I thought, you know, I'm going to learn about the theory of special relativity and this idea of, you know, time dilation and things like that. And I don't blame the lecturer, because it's the way that universities work and things like that. But I just somehow, you know, it was disappointing, because there seemed to be no sense of wonder in him as he, you know, explained, you know, the theory. I must admit, I didn't actually grasp it terribly well either. I have in later life, you know, I'm fine understanding it now. But yeah, I can see that was the thing that sort of drew me, this sense of sort of mystery or wonder. But in a strange way, I also felt that somehow the academic study of physics was in itself was not going to answer any of the questions that were kind of there. It's not to say that somebody couldn't study physics and have those questions arise in themselves, but I would not get answers from anybody about it.
But if anyone was to make a film about your life or about any physicist, that would have to be... That would be non-negotiable. You couldn't have somebody giving a dry sort of matter of fact, this is what it is. There would have to be some kind of motive, purpose, vision, dream, experience, emotion attached to that. In other words, what are the reasons why we do what we do?
Yeah.
I found it with my podcast that I wanted to ask people, you know, the big questions like, you know, what are your drivers, or, you know, who are you, kind of thing. Because I'd hear people give academic talks.
Yes.
And I'd sometimes think, okay, this is great. They spent a lot of time on this, and maybe they've had buyouts from teaching. And so, you know, this has been an investment. But what makes them get up in the morning to do this? Why are they doing this project? And if I couldn't get that, like with your teacher in Durham, if I couldn't see that, I wasn't sure I wanted to try and open those doors. I really wanted somebody to say, this is my passion. This is why I'm passionate. This is where the passion has come from. And then I feel, okay, that door is now opening, and I'm happy to walk through that door. Others, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm here because I should be here, I have to be here. And rather than actually, this is something that is, you know, a good use of my time.
Yeah.
So that notion of wonder, I think, is quite a compelling one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think these are all very interesting questions, really, because I have no answers on this, but I suppose it's almost a bit like Jung and some of the other, you know, psychologists are talking about, you know, the notion of drives.
Yeah.
So there's no question that, you know, that we seem to have inherent drives, you know, of different kinds. And, you know, you see that, you know, I think even in the academic world, that people obviously, something makes them get out of bed and research, you know, furiously, you know, the history of the Tudor kings or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Or indeed, you know, some subject in physics. It's hard to put your finger on what it is, you know. But I think, you know, I mean, and in some of those, it seems to me, they may be ordinary human factors of the fact that, or a mixture, like, you know, one comes to the academic world perhaps with a fascination for something, but inevitably sort of worldly factors, you know, creep in. You know, you need to be published, you need to, you know, maybe get grant income. People like prestige, they like to be, you know, have a pat on the back and things. So they're kind of two, very difficult to disentangle, if that makes sense, you know. So, I mean, I have to say that's probably, you know, my experience. I always liked research. I couldn't honestly say, you know, what is it that made me want to you know, to do it. I always had a certain pleasure in doing mathematics, for example. Physics seemed rather interesting. But as I got a bit older, I suppose, you know, my questions have become a bit more internal about human life and relationships and things like that, you know.
Yeah, and those are the sort of things that perhaps once upon a time we weren't allowed to ask, because when I was at school, my recollection is that, you know, we would study the subjects, but there was never really a sense of motivation or drive. We'd study religion, but without sort of feeling the religion. We might read great poetry or literature. Yes. I remember doing Shakespeare or Jane Austen, but it was never, you know, and you may or may not enjoy it, but that was often what put a lot of people off, you know, that they were exposed to Shakespeare when they were too young to really grasp it.
Sure.
And it put them off for life in some cases.
Yes.
Because they felt that, you know, the teacher was effectively saying that their thoughts or their views were wrong. And so, you know, you're not going to read something quote for pleasure if actually you've already been told that your views are not good enough on that. So you're going to find some other interest.
Sure.
And maybe in later life you come at it in a different way. So it's a good job that when I was at school, we didn't have I did music, actually, it was my worst subject. We did look at the Beatles, but I suppose my interest in the charts and so on was actually mercifully removed from anything on the curriculum.
Yes.
So the things that I was really passionate about, I could cultivate in my
really
own
touched,
way,
yes,
rather
yes,
than something where a teacher would actually say, "Oh, you know, that's you don't know the answers."
Yeah. No, I definitely relate a lot to what you're saying there. You know,
but as we start to wrap up, Chris, I was just thinking, the question I always ask at this point is whether your memories are sort of predominantly positive ones. Is there a sense that you look back on your life and career and can start to see that actually, maybe because of the whole sort of trajectory thing, or the fact that maybe you're starting to answer or address some of those questions that maybe once upon a time you didn't quite have the same opportunity or capacity to do. But would you say that those memories of yours are predominantly positive ones?
Yes, I would, Chris. You know, I mean, again, apologies if it sounds a bit corny. Of course, like everybody of my age, you know, one has difficult periods in life and things. But I feel very, you know, very grateful, you know, for the kind of life I've had and the upbringing, you know, my family and things like that. So yes, definitely.
Yeah. And the converse of that, though, as well, I suppose, about whether negative experiences can sometimes... I suppose, actually, a question I always ask as well is whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences, because maybe you can think, at the time it was horrible, but like we were saying about the school, you may have gone, you didn't go to Eton, but maybe the experiences that you had made you a better person because of it, because you have you have to deal with reality.
That is an interesting thing. I mean, I couldn't honestly, I don't think nostalgia would probably be the right word for it, Chris, but I can certainly think of things like, I'll just give you one concrete example, but when, in fact, Anna and I and our son first came to Canterbury, which would have been, I think, 1995, I think, something like that, January 95. At that time, we bought our first house in London. And to keep the story short, my wife was then pregnant with our second child and couldn't work. And we let our house in London, but I'm afraid to sort of classic nightmare tenants. I mean, I won't burden you with the story, but it really was a bit of a nightmare, because it meant we received no money at all when we first came to Canterbury. We were renting a house because we couldn't afford to sell the house in London, and so at that time 90% of my salary, that's the gospel truth, went on just the interest payments on the mortgage and the rental. So I had to basically do sort of private tuition just to get, you know, enough money, and then go through all this thing through the courts to try and get these people out and things. So it was very difficult and unpleasant experience, not the most unpleasant I've had in my life. But strangely, I look back on it and I'm not sorry it happened.
Mm.
I wouldn't care to repeat it. But I think, you know, I can say that for many rather difficult experiences that you know, I mean, obviously one hopefully learns from them, but it's just a strange sense that I don't look back and think it wasn't, you know, like I'd want to be there again, but I'm not sorry they happened. Something was learned.
Yeah.
Something was, you know.
Yeah. No, yeah, and I think there's some experience I've had that have brought me out of my shell in a way, because, and often it can be bad relationships. It can be all sorts of things where something is horrible and you know that something's wrong. But what that does to you is make you say, okay, why is it wrong? Why did this not work when it should have worked? Or why did I think that something was going to be amazing and it wasn't amazing? And there's always that risk that you'll end up repeating yourself, you know, and who yeah. hasn't found themselves in almost like, you know, thinking, I've been here before. Oh, no. You know, it's almost like, you know, have I not learnt the lesson? Or, yeah, but often it can be entirely external things happen, or it can be because of the sort of the way, yeah. the things that we're seeking. But when you have that notion of reflection, it can be empowering, because then you can stop and just say, okay, it was horrible at the time. I wouldn't want to go through it again. But having gone through that, what have I learned? And you know, people often joke and say to me, oh, Chris, you should, you know, write a book about this. You're thinking, well, you know, how do you know I haven't, sort of thing. Yeah. But often that's the only way, because you need to do something with it. And it's how you respond to those events
that
actually are the measure of who you are, rather than the events in themselves.
I mean, just briefly, Chris, again, it's sort of come to me as we were speaking, but I think, you know, one of the things, when I look back to that particular episode, which, I don't know, externally may not sound so dreadful, but it was actually very, very difficult, you know, say, under, you know, just beginning a new job, you know, having no money, the unpleasantness of it all, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because they really were not nice people. And I think the thing that I remember being sort of quite grateful for was, I think I could honestly say that I had a rather sort of moment when I, because, you know, I'm not ashamed to say I had quite violent thoughts, you know. I mean, there was a part of me. I'm not a particularly passive sort of, you know, what's the word, a placid sort of person. You know, I had some quite sort of unpleasant thoughts about what I'd like to do to these people. But I had sort of a moment when I sort of felt quite deep in myself the futility of violence, you know, that in fact it wasn't necessary. And that it sounds almost comical, but I just somehow felt that things will go the way they need to do. In other words, the old saying, as you sow, so shall you reap. It could sound terribly trite to say that, but I would say I had a felt deep experience of that I didn't actually need to do anything, really. And that in some strange way, Providence would just do what needed to be done, you know. So, you know, I remember that, Arthur, this is 30 years later, you know. Just think that, that's just an element of what you're saying, really, that I wouldn't care to repeat it, but I'm not sorry it happened. And that was something that came from it, you know, a kind of sort of drop of magic in a way.
But also, you think of literature, you think of films, people who lead sort of dull, ordinary lives are not, you know, who cares, even though actually living a dull, ordinary life it's like a good thing, because it shows that you're not doing anything horrible and, you know, offensive and, you know, but when things happen, sometimes it's how you respond, that's always, it's the whole, that problem of evil question, you know, it's how you respond to something rather than the thing in itself. And that, I think, is where you get into the territory of myth and tragedy and drama and life, and you know that's why we read novels, that's why we go to watch films, because we see ourselves played out in those protagonists. But what do you think your younger self thought you'd end up doing? In other words, obviously physics is something that had always sort of been with you, but would your younger self, when you were at primary school in Brighton or whatever, be surprised to find out what you're doing now?
I don't think so. I mean, I think when I was young, I think there were probably two things that I thought I might like to be. So this is like primary school age. I thought I might be something like a scientist or a mathematician, or I might be a footballer. Mm. Okay, but I'm not, you know, that's not unusual, of course, in somebody so young. But when I got to be a teenager, and I actually do have it as a sort of hobby, and both my brothers are builders, but I thought I'll probably end up being a scientist or a builder, which is far apart. But actually, you know, and yet, you know, that is actually something I enjoy a lot now. So I'm quite a keen sort of DIYer, and maybe it's in the blood. But
Well, so, I suppose conversely, would your brothers, was there ever a part of them that wanted to do what you did?
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so. No.
Yeah.
So I think the answer is no. Probably, you know, the younger self probably wouldn't be too surprised.
And I got one more question for you, Chris, which is, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, hopefully a looking forward, you know. I do say as you get older you look back more, but no, I think if you look back too much as you get older, you're on the way out, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, on that bleak but very reflective note, Chris, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
My pleasure.